On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. As somebody who's read a book on occasion, and I know that's hard to believe for those of you who are longtime listeners, one of the first books that ever kept me awake all night long was Man in the High Castle, and the incredible and actually, frankly, quite terse Philip K. Dick book is being adapted into a series. The man responsible for it is sitting across from me, Frank Spotnitz. You know him from his work on The X-Files. Some of the greatest parts of the mythology ever, including Memento Mori. First of all, Frank, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And did you have a similar experience? Because finally, you can't predict where that book is going to go.
That book made a big impression on me. I read it in college. I was at UCLA. And I was a huge consumer of movies and television, as I'm sure you were. And I was so used to the good guys winning. And here's a book where not only did the good guys lose, they lost a long time ago, and it's about living in defeat. And it really stuck with me that there's no inevitability to the good side winning. You can't count on the right thing happening. So it's just stayed with me ever since. And I guess it was like 3 years ago, I was asked by Scott Free, Ridley Scott's company, if I wanted to adapt it, and I just said yes immediately.
Because they've had that material for about 10 years or so. I know there's like an announcement it's going to be a BBC series like 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
That never materialized, and there's talk about a movie happening as well.
They had a really hard time getting it made, and then they wanted to take one last swing at it with me, with Sci-Fi originally actually. So I wrote the first two episodes. My friend Tom Schnauz from Breaking Bad wrote 3 and 4, and Sci-Fi passed. And it was really dead for 2 years. They were just about to lose the rights to make it when I got a call from a guy I knew who used to work at ABC who just joined Amazon. And he said, "Do you have any scripts you love that haven't been made?" I said, "Yeah, The Man in the High Castle." And then the rest, as they say, is history.
Because I get that. I mean, a place like Sci-Fi, they want at some point a hero.
Yeah. You know, also, it's a really expensive show to make. You know, it's 1962 that never was. The pilot alone is New York, San Francisco, and Cannon City in the Rocky Mountains. And the subject matter is pretty, you know, potentially offensive. There's a lot of landmines you find out when you're dealing with Nazis and the Imperial Japanese.
Why don't we, for those who don't know the material, why don't you tell them a little bit of what The Man in the High Castle is about?
So the idea of the book and the TV series is that the Allies lost World War II. So it's 1962. You know, a whole generation has grown up in defeat in the United States. The eastern half of the country is occupied by the Nazis, the west coast by the Imperial Japanese, and then the Rocky Mountains are like a neutral zone between the two fascist powers.
And it's the book is scary in the way that only a book that can be written by a man who basically took acid and threw the I Ching to plot it could be.
Well, that's why the book is so great, really, because his mind is so rich and interesting and challenging. And I've read the book several times now. I don't think I fully understand everything that's in there, but you know, he was way ahead of his time. It's kind of a cliche to say it, but it's absolutely true. It's not a resistance story. You know, it's about deeper things, to me anyway, like the themes that I drew from it that I've tried to bring into the TV series are how do you remain human if you're living in an inhuman world, which I think is a really resonant theme right now. And this is a much tougher theme, but what's real? What's the nature of reality? And you can imagine that's a difficult concept to grasp, let alone to dramatize, but that's what we try to do in the series.
But also, and there's something that ran through so many of the mythology episodes of X-Files, the hunger to will something better for yourself.
Yes.
No matter what your circumstances are.
Yes.
I mean, that becomes a kind of spiritual ambition.
Yes.
That's something that I found that you connected to this that belongs to you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think about that a lot, that, you know, if we were living in a world like that, you know, we'd all like to think we'd be in the resistance. We all like to think we'd stand up against evil and oppression, and while they're dragging the Jews away, that we'd speak up. But the truth is, and I really believe this, 99.8% of us wouldn't. You know, we'd look after our families. We'd go to work. We may not like what's happening, but we wouldn't have the courage to step out of line. And that's very moving to me, the people that do and why they do. And I wanted to portray that in a really real way. And I think this show has been unsettling to people because it takes place in the United States. And to see Americans in that situation, we like to think that can never happen to us. But of course, it could. It could happen anywhere.
It's one of the first things that shocked me about the show is seeing that visualization of the flag. Talk about the creation of that.
Well, one of the realizations we had when we were preparing the pilot was the power of symbols. And so, you know, the flag, Times Square, Mount Rushmore, you know, these things are deeply embedded in our subconscious minds as Americans. And so when you take those things and you deface them with a swastika, it really hits you on a deep level. So we begin with this newsreel in a movie theater in New York City off Times Square.
In fact, the opening credits have that flicker that you hear the audio of a projector.
That's right. Yeah, and the opening credits have Mount Rushmore, and there's sort of a film of parachutists, like tears coming down the face of the presidents. But, you know, it's storytelling with a visual, which is my favorite kind of thing. It's just a picture that tells you so much about this world.
And that's what happens. There's so much that we just see. And we did a LACMA event, and we were talking about that teaser trailer that ran during the World Series, where you just, because it goes by so fast initially, and I had seen episodes, so I knew what was going on. I was talking to people, did I see the nuts? Did I see a swastika? Because
right.
It goes by so fast. And then the teaser trailer takes time to show us what was almost subliminal in the first half of it.
Yes. I think that was part of our storytelling strategy was, you know, the Nazis in this show are us. You know, most of them are American Nazis, and they've co-opted a lot of American culture. And what's unsettling is to see how close some of those situations feel to situations that are very familiar to us. So there's an episode 6, that takes place on VA Day, which is Victory in America Day, and it's like a Thanksgiving celebration. And you can see it. It's very, very close, and yet it's off.
It was just because I've seen that episode, just the casualness of saying "see Heil" when people walk into somebody's home.
Yeah.
It's so unsettling.
Yeah.
And as we're talking about this, you remind me of what Philip K. Dick said about the reason he was never able to write the sequel is that he couldn't go back to that again.
Yeah, it's a very dark place, very dark people. But one thing that I felt like in writing the Rufus Sewell character, who's John Smith, who's the Nazi officer in New York City in the TV series, is he's done really evil things. He's still doing really evil things, but he's rationalized them to himself. And he can still go home to his wife and children and still be a really good husband and a loving father. And those two things exist side by side. And we don't like to think that's true, you know, because Hitler was a madman. A lot of the Nazi officers were madmen. But there were a lot of Nazis who were not madmen, who were people who otherwise would be good people, but it somehow rationalized that it was okay to do evil things. And that makes me think, you know, it makes me think not just about Nazis and about Germans, but about all of us and things we do that we rationalize.
It's a truth. We're talking about I don't think it's science fiction because I don't think Philip K. Dick ever wrote science fiction. It's the real fantasy of the adaptation of Man in the High Castle, which is on Amazon. Its adapter, Frank Spotnitz, who's done so much great work, is sitting across from me right now. But I think that strain of, again, well, I was talking about that kind of spiritual ambition. Some of these characters you've written in X-Files episodes have been people who just wanted something better and were just receiving bad news mm-hmm. and couldn't see a way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what was one of the first things that attracted you to that kind of character and characterization?
Well, it's one of my convictions about life. It's going to sound very cheerful, but I actually believe
as a man who lives in the 7-hour arrondissement in Paris,
your
life is so hard. No wonder, Frank, you feel a need to kind of exorcise these demons.
But I really do think life doesn't reward you for doing the right thing. I actually think in a lot of ways you pay for doing the right thing, for acting in accordance with your conscience. And that, in fact, that's your only reward. And I think that's sort of a theme that runs through a lot of my writing, is the importance of doing the right thing, even though no one's going to thank you for it.
Also, this thing that runs through Philip K. Dick, which is the idea of how do you present yourself to an institution that you know may not be doing the right thing?
Yeah.
I mean, that was so much a big part of the X-Files,
yes.
You know, that dynamic between Mulder and Scully, was the institution right, or was following your instinct right?
That's absolutely right. And I also think part of what made the X-Files interesting for me to do anyway was understanding the reasons why the quote-unquote bad guys were doing what they were doing. Because obviously nobody thinks they're a bad guy. Everybody has their reasons. And I think the same could be said of the quote-unquote bad guys in Man in the High Castle. You know, they have a code and they have a belief system that they're willing to kill people to support. And that's when it gets dangerous.
Well, the other interesting thing too that I think maybe sort of subtextually sort of ran through the X-Files, but is very much a part of Philip K. Dick, is the idea of technology, the modern world steals your soul. At some point, if you give into the modern world, it runs through Android's dream of electric sheep, or I can dream for you wholesale, or definitely a part of this. If you're in the modern world and you give into these devices, they take something away from you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Modernity does that. And the idea too, because there's so many characters in X-Files who are recluses and hermits who try to stay away from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you've written it, as a matter of fact, who those people who did that.
I mean, I think that's sort of there's sort of a reactionary thing in all science fiction to change, to modernism, to technology. And for me and Philip K. Dick, it's part of that theme again of what is human and how do you hold on to your humanity, and technology is another thing that can threaten it. And I certainly think about that all the time with all of us walking around with our cell phones, you know, which are like they're like extensions of who we are now, right? They're part of our memory is resident in these. I don't know my phone number anymore. And it's changing what it means to be human. I think there's a dependency now on technology that we didn't used to have before.
In the original material, I mean, almost nobody comes to a good end.
Right. No.
And I don't know, because if you're going to do a show, you figure how many seasons you're going to do. How do you deal with that? For example, the character of Joe.
Yeah.
You know nothing's good going to happen to him. And I won't go too far into that. But
right.
You've made decisions already just by seeing the sixth episode that have changed who and what he is.
Yes. What I decided when I approached this show, because, you know, obviously I did X-Files for a long time, and that's a big mythology show. And how you end a mythology-driven series is a big challenge, right? As X-Files showed, as Lost showed. And I wanted to learn lessons from the past. And so what I really thought deeply about before I started writing the pilot was what are the character journeys? You know, what's Juliana in particular? What's her journey? And if I know that, and if I know the ending of that, that's more important than all the plot stuff. You know, that's more important than what are the films, where do they come from? Because anybody has answers to that. Everybody on the internet's going to have 1,000 answers immediately to where the films come from. I can't beat them at that game. All I can control is the emotional journey of the character, you know, which I think a perfect example of that is what my friend Vince Gilligan did on Breaking Bad. I mean, that's a beautifully executed character journey, and people love that show to the very end because they were following Walter White, not because of, you know, who's going to win the drug wars. You know, that's the plot. It's not what really matters to the viewer.
Because I guess as you're saying this too, we live in an era now where that kind of second-guessing and filling in the holes in mythology and the kind of thing that used to be called fan fiction is now an inevitable part of the way these your idea or your approach to something like this,
That's
isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And you can't compete against it. And I'm not even going to try.
And you were the dawn of it with X-Files.
I was. And from the very beginning, I have to tell you, I always went online. I still do. I mean, there's like 18,000 comments on Man in the High Castle. I've probably read every one of them, which is, as you can imagine, is painful at times. But I really do feel like, you know, you're a storyteller because you want to communicate with people. And I've always been very interested. Well, how am I doing? You know, what are you taking out of what I'm saying to you? And I'm willing to endure the pain of those really nasty comments to get the insight into how everybody else is receiving it.
Well, we just learned a lot about my guest, Frank Spotnitz. He's the adapter of the terrific version of Man in the High Castle, and it's on Amazon right now. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the poor, sad, lonely Europhile Frank Spotnitz. He's adapted Philip K. Dick's Man in the High Castle for Amazon. That film you just alluded to, which is The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, is a big part, in fact, a much bigger part of the TV show than it is in the book. I mean, yes. In the book, it's allusion, and it's all about characters reacting to it. It almost is, it's a MacGuffin, really, in the book.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, The Man in the High Castle, Abinson, has written a novel where we won the war. And that was sort of the first thing that occurred to me in adapting it was that this should be a film, not a novel.
So why did you decide to do that?
Because obviously this is a visual medium.
Right.
And I just thought the power of seeing these films that we've all seen our whole lives, it would be so deep and profound to see it projected on a screen versus hearing about a novel somebody else has written. And I think that is true. It's like, you know, history is surprisingly personal. We all grow up with these images of victory in World War II, and you can't help but be affected by them. It's a change, obviously, then in the science fiction part of the show because these are physical films that have to be explained. But I'll be really disappointed if the only reason people are watching the show is to find out, you know, where the films come from. I mean, I'm going to answer that, but the real story.
Are you
to me,
because it's really not about that?
It's not about that. I'm going to answer it in a fashion.
Okay.
I think I have to answer it in a fashion. I think it's a mystery, and the audience won't feel satisfied unless I address that. But to me, the bigger thing is how these characters, particularly Juliana, Joe, and Frank, live through the challenges of this world and how they end up. That to me is the real heart of the show.
And you've made – and talk about casting your Juliana because you made her less of a kind of a Camille, less of a sufferer in this. She's a much more active figure because, again, Philip K. Dick really – it's almost like you're taking your leave from him. The plot didn't matter to him because you try to sort of – if you do the plot in schematic terms, you would talk yourself out of reading the book.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's – that's not what – that's not what's important about the book. But obviously you're doing television. You know, the narrative part is really important. So I took the characters of Juliana and Frank, who are already split up as the novel begins, and I sort of rewound so they're together at the beginning of the television series. And, you know, she is hope. You know, the films are hope. And
did you feel like you had to do that as kind of a counterpoint to the sheer bleakness? I mean, the kind of sumptuous bleakness of the book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and also because that's what I believe. I mean, despite all my despair about a lot of things in the world, I remain hopeful. I do think love is stronger than hate. I do think, you know, as President Obama likes to say, that the long arc of history bends toward justice. You know, terrible, terrible things happen, like the Holocaust happened. But over the long, long, long haul, which unfortunately many generations don't live to see, I do think the world gets better. So I wouldn't be honest to myself unless I told a story that was ultimately hopeful.
Because I find it interesting, and it's something you really get a chance to play with because you've extended a pretty small book, is showing the idea of what it's like for kids who've grown up knowing nothing but this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think one of the most disturbing scenes in the pilot, and I won't spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but it's a scene where Joe stops, his tire's blown, and there's a state trooper, and he's talking about, you know, the war 17 years ago.
And there's a physical moment that really sort of
that's a scene that's not even plot. You could take that out. It wouldn't change the plot. But it just tells you so much about what it would be like if we'd lost and if we lived in that world. And I also think a lot doing the show about the sacrifices that generation made so that we won the war and how really each generation is called upon to make sacrifices to preserve this idea of America. And some generations do it better than others. And again, it's not inevitable that the good guys are going to win. It's not inevitable that our country will live up to the ideals that it stands for. It's incumbent upon us to do it.
Because what I find so interesting about this is the idea of making something about fascism dominating this country, because it's really – there hasn't been a war fought in this country for two centuries where there was a real loss. And the book takes off from basically – it's not we didn't lose the war. We didn't get in it.
Right.
And but the idea of this weight of being dominated by something that's not part of the building blocks of this country is, to me, a truly terrifying idea.
I think it's very unsettling for people. I mean, I would say I think people in the South, because of the Civil War, I think there is a degree of feeling like they lost, you know.
Which is why they probably still cling to it so much.
I think so. I think that's – and it's a trauma. It's a trauma that they still are feeling the after effects of. And I think to me, you know, we're still living in the shadow of 9/11. I still feel it. I feel the energy. There is this dread and this fear. And I think, you know, one of the things, one of the hopeful things about Man in the High Castle is you watch characters respond to fear, overcome it, and do heroic things. And you see how hard it is and scary it is. And there's no, you know, there's no guarantee you'll live through it. But there is a kind of salvation in living for something other than your own safety, other than, you know, your own small patch of earth. And that's one of the lines that Tagomi, the Japanese character, says in the pilot. He says, you know, the Nazis only believe in a world they can see. And I think, you know, there's a danger sometimes in our modern capitalist consumerist society. We're all materialists. You know, we're all pragmatic. It's like, no, there's values. There's things that matter more than this stuff. And we should remember that.
It's true. We're talking about the adaptation of the Philip K. Dick novel, Man in the High Castle, with its adapter, Frank Spotnitz, of course, you know from his work on The X-Files, among many other things. I guess I just find myself thinking, too, that just in production design and realizing this world, it sounds really daunting to me. Do you have any sense of how hard it would be to do?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in writing the script, obviously, I had a lot of help from Philip K. Dick, of course, because he'd imagined the world in the book. But then when you actually go to make a television series, you know, literally there are 1,000 decisions easily to make in the pilot. And you know that you're going to have to live with those decisions the rest of the series, however long it goes. So we did think very deeply about everything. You know, what do the post boxes look like? You know, are there monorails in New York versus, you know, a subway system? All these things that have to be informed by your speculation about where America would have been if we'd lost the war. I thought about George Lucas, to be honest, and having to establish everything about that world before he started the first movie. But the other challenge of it that's kind of interesting that I didn't think about till we had to do it is it has to feel like the past. It has to feel like 1962, or it's going to feel false to us. But it also has to be off. And so there's that tension between, oh, yeah, that's right, that's 1962, but it's not our 1962. That's reflected throughout the design and the costumes and, you know, the props, all the visual choices in the show.
Were there things that you watched to prepare for? Were the movies that you looked at to give you a sense of what you might want to do with this?
Well, you know, Ridley Scott, who's one of the executive producers of the show, had very clear visual ideas that he wanted us to consult before we approached the show. So, you know, I think for me anyway, one of the big things was The Conformist, the Bertolucci film, which we looked at a lot. Edward Hopper paintings, Blade Runner, of course. So those were, for me anyway, those were the ones. We actually had a whole book put together of things to consult. And David Simmel, the pilot director, and Daniel Percival, the series lead director, spent a lot of time studying these references. And I think, you know, you could see it in the show if you were looking for it.
Certainly. I mean, The Conformist comes to mind because it really is a movie about people in the world like this, except it's not an alternate reality. It's the world, but it's also an action film. I mean, for those who haven't seen The Conformist, there's the first time I ever saw somebody toss a gun from one person to another.
It's
in The Conformist.
Right.
It's been stolen from ever since.
Right.
But it's also a world that takes place mostly under basically very gray skies.
Yeah.
And so when we see sunlight in The Man in the High Castle, it's really kind of shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't want to give too much away to say when the sunlight comes in which episode, but to see sunlight on those visual signifiers of this world that hasn't happened is really something. Because the gray days and the cloudy days, and we won't say where these clouds come from, when we get sun, talk a little bit about doing that. It's almost like you can't, this world really exists now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was doing research in Berlin. And I toured the Stasi prison. And a woman from the Berlin Film Commission went on the tour with me. And afterwards, she said, you know, that was really awful. I was really shaken by what I just saw. But I have to tell you, I grew up in East Germany. And you know, I didn't know these things were going on. And obviously, they're awful. But to be honest, I still miss it because I felt safe. I knew who my neighbors were. There was always bread on the shelves. There were only two types of ketchup, but who cares? Who needs seven? And, you know, we don't like to think. We always imagine East Germany or, you know, Soviet Russia, it's gray and it's dreary and people are miserable. But there are things about those societies that people liked. And that's counterintuitive to us as Americans. And there's ways to think about freedom. You know, you can say, well, my freedom is I'm guaranteed a home. My freedom is I'm guaranteed a job. I can't worship the way I want. I can't say the things I want to say. I can't be the right race or religion or sexual orientation. But there's other kinds of freedom. And it's a different way of looking at the world. And so there is sun in that world, right? There is. It'd be lying to say there isn't. But what it does to me is it reminds me of what my values are and what I believe you should fight for. And that's, I think that's why this show, to the degree it resonates, I think that's why, is because it's not this artificial dystopian world. It's not a world where we're pushing it. You know, it's believable. It's like, oh, yeah, I can believe that's the way that world would have worked. And there is sun and there's also a cloud.
What's the breakdown between those who, because I know of a few Philip K. Dick adherents who, if you change anything, they immediately go crazy. What's the breakdown between those people who are really zealots about that versus people who don't know that material and coming to the first time? How have the response has been based on your scanning of the 18,000 plus?
Yeah, I mean, I was really nervous about that. And you know, when I first looked at the book to adapt, I didn't want to change anything. But then I realized I'm not doing him any favors if I don't change things. You have to.
And finally, I mean, because it's a downward spiral in that way his books all are.
Yes. Yeah, you have to. It's a different – and his daughter, Issa Dick Hackett, is a producer in the show. And she approved the changes that I'd made and understood why and continues to. And she's still working very closely on the series. But yes, based on my reading of the 18,000 plus comments, I have to say, you know, the vast majority of people approve of and understand the changes that I've made, which is a great relief.
How far do you want to go? I mean, how many seasons would you like to say? Have you given yourself an idea of how far you want to proceed with this?
Well, in the beginning, I thought, I don't see how this goes more than, you know, 3 years or something. But as I've gotten deeper into it, I realized, you know, you've got the whole world. You've literally got the whole world that you could explore in this show. And it's part of the form of Amazon, you know, of a streaming broadcaster, that it's not like an episodic TV series where you've got to do the same thing every week. And that can run out, you know. But this is more novelistic. And, you know, if there's a season two, it's going to be nothing like season one.
Wow, because I guess as I hear this, I wonder about, you've got to build story that you pay off in a TV show like this. You're doing an extended narrative in a way that I don't even think it was like that Philip K. Dick wasn't interested in. I just think he had this, it's almost the equivalent of being colorblind. He just didn't see plot. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't matter to him. And if you look at, again, if you describe any of those books, nobody would read them. And the movies, be it Minority Report or Total Recall, used those books as taking off points. And as does Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's what you learned from all those adaptations as well. You're better off imputing something to them rather than trying to be faithful to them.
Yeah, although I will say I wanted to be the most faithful.
You said that before. Did you really?
Yeah,
because
I really
did. Even science, there's a whole science fiction aspect in the book that so far is not extant in the series.
It comes in.
Oh, does it?
It does, but slowly. It's like my big fear is that the science fiction aspect will eclipse everything else. You know, it could swallow it all up because it is so mind-bending and trippy. But it's an important part of the narrative. It really is. And so I do intend to fully explore that, but just slowly, because I don't want to shatter the illusion of believability, and that could really do it.
It's such a big shift that you have to be invested in the way you can only be invested in the book. I mean, because you got to find a way to visualize that climax of the book too, which is kind of crazy.
I'm going there.
Well, you have to come back when you do that. Will you come back, please?
Yeah, sure. I'd be delighted.
It's my pleasure, please. My guest is Frank Spotnitz, the man who's brave enough to take on Man with the High Castle and survive for at least 10 episodes on Amazon. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Recording engineer here in the safe and free United States in Santa Monica is Kat Yor, who also mixes the show. The associate producer who edits the show is Blake Veit. I'm going to go out and try one of 100 different brands of ketchup. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.